record here.
Yeah, I'll start and then I'll invite Adam and Mark to jump in. But we had such a good time at the conference that we wanted to share with anyone who wasn't able to attend. And as the email said, relive it for those of us who were able to attend because we liked it so much. So what we thought we would do, and you know, I asked for a few volunteers of those who were there, is we'll pop up a poll of the, and these are the sessions that people signed up to share about, because if we didn't have a sign up, I didn't put in the poll. But maybe you can all like pipe in, take a vote of which one you'd like to revisit, and then we can share on the top choices on the poll. And part of this, I just wanted to lay some groundwork here before we do that, is to kind of gauge your interest in different sessions so that we can better serve you throughout the whole year with other content. While you are polling, I am going to share some of the dancing with markers that we had during the sessions. So you can see that it was a graphic facilitator. I'm just gonna go ahead and share that while we're doing this. And while I do that, Mark.
Ready for me to launch or?
Hang on one sec. Mark and Adam, anything that I missed there in terms of teeing this up? Probably something.
No, I don't think so. Were we gonna flash up the agenda and walk through it, or are we just gonna do the poll?
The poll is kind of the agenda because whatever sessions, and you told me not to make slides, but I made slides anyway because I couldn't.
No, that's great. I wasn't at the conference, so I attended two sessions virtually. Tanya gave me backdoor links to a couple of the sessions that I was able to listen into. So that was fun. So I'm really looking forward to this as well, because I wasn't able to be there, unfortunately.
Cool. So let's pop up the poll and see which ones you want to relive. And we'll relive as many as we can in priority order. Relive or share, I guess. I'm gonna pick the one.
You can only pick one, right?
I'm only letting you pick one, but if we run out, we can always rerun the poll.
Well, we're gonna have this split across all 12 that are in here. So right now there is no majority. It is
sharing.
If it's helpful, we do have one presenter that's joining us. Nuala's here today, and she was one of the presenters.
I would love, yeah.
Yeah, for the fluid workforce session. So that is a nice little bonus.
I missed that session, so I would definitely love to hear from Nuala.
That's right. So I volunteered to share the key takeaways, but maybe I don't need to because Nuala, you can do it yourself.
All right. Yeah. So it looks like all 19 of you have voted, and as I suspected,
what, it's a completely flat across? Okay, let's see.
There's one that did get 4 votes, which is the highest number, and that was the new org design capability session.
We've got new org design, disruption resistant org, Upwork, and Michael Arena 2023 and beyond seem to be the top 3.
Yeah, so why don't we start with the new org design capability. Now, I can't get to my spreadsheet here. Oh, yes,
I can. Which was Mark.
Okay, thank you. So, Mark, you want to give us some key takeaways from new org design capability? Oh, you're on mute, Mark.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah. The folks, we had a couple of folks from State Farm, Mary and Lauren, talk about their journey, so to speak, of trying to build, you know, org design practice internally. And, you know, they shared a bit about their approach, the maturity model that they've kind of created. They were influenced by a few others, but so they kind of shared their approach to building the capability where they thought they were. Yet a lot of the session was really designed towards sourcing, you know, crowdsourcing, if you will, insights from all the folks, you know, in the session on what their experience has been. And so they kind of polled, you know, what has been your experience, internal, external? And then someone realized, hey, a lot of us have been both. So they got a good sense of who was in the room. And then they posed some different questions or problem statements. I think I've got them here. And you could check them out, but it was, you know, just things like, you know, what is the roadmap, the capability, How do you manage scope creep? What systemic elements sustain OD? Program delivery, what and who got into role. So they just really teed up an opportunity for the different tables to address those problem statements and had some thought starters and talk about what they would do. And then we had a report out of the five or six different groups and then had a little discussion on that. So that was really what it was. And then they shared those insights in this. So if you go through Hoover, checked out the documents, you could see the outputs from the session. That was the gist. Anyone else in there? As far as insights, it was a variety of things. But questions, I guess, of those, I could share statements, but any questions just before I can elaborate a bit more on maybe insights or specifics.
Actually, just on this call, how many people have we got that are either doing that, building a internal function now or have done it in the past? We got, I know it's a bit hard to see, but have we got anyone that's doing it now?
Can you repeat your question, Keith? Sorry about that.
Yeah, just interested on this call. Have we got people who are doing that now, like building an internal function, or they've done it in the past, an internal org design function?
I did it in the past when I first joined OnSemi. We were kind of doing that. It was less around org design than it was actually change management, but a lot of it kind of went back to design. Every project somebody brought in looking to learn about change management, it was really a design problem. So we were I was brought in to help do that, and it's kind of over the years gone in a completely different direction now. And what we were building, new exec teams come in. I think everything we built has been somewhat just dismantled over time now. But we were kind of taking an approach where we were trying to teach people to do it for themselves. So rather than be practitioners who went around doing it, we tried to teach people in the org who had been given these projects to lead it themselves. And then there was a little bit of time where we were also working on projects. So kind of that two-pronged approach where it was teaching people to fish, and then where the project was critical enough, we would be assigned to them. And that's kind of the approach we took. But since then, it's been somewhat dismantled. But we decided to take that approach because usually people are given projects as a challenge and a growth opportunity. So we thought, okay, let's focus on teaching them because that's just the way the model worked. So that's the approach we took.
May I interject, Keith? In my company, we don't have an org design function per se. It's almost treated like a capability. But tapping on what Adam was saying, what I have found out at least, is that when you talk about large scale transformation or anything that is of significant strategic importance, although the organization keeps talking about change and change management and whatnot, the reality is that the what of the change can only be discovered via design, right? And I'm not saying about changing necessarily structures, but discovering or uncovering what are those dynamics and patterns in the system that are creating that's where you define the what. But the struggle that I see is trying to override that need for everyone to have like a short answer and a predictable process and a repetitive process, which is what has been sold by change management, right? They say, well, if you do this and if you train and if you communicate, you will be on the other side, which it's not accurate, I think, debatable. So that's my perception. I think it's a struggle because when people actually perceive the benefits of the design, then they are more willing, but they don't even call it design. They're like, well, you're just doing a strategy. You're just doing, it's it's confusing our world as org designers, I believe. Yeah. Being matched with change management, honestly, that like that's a struggle.
Interesting.
Within Amoco Corporation, we had a small group. Majority of the group was focused on training and development within the IT North American group. But we tended to evolve from training to organization development and from organization development into design as we added to our product and service portfolio. So one of the things, one of the avenues we pursued in terms of meeting the needs of our clients was a general move to go to self-directed work teams. So what we found as we wanted to do was to become self-directed ourselves so we could have a visceral understanding of what that was. And to be able to do that, we had to redesign ourselves. And in the process, started supporting other functions that were implementing self-directed work teams. And that's how we got into organization design. It was more evolutionary.
Mark, was there anything in the session about these comments we've just heard?
Yeah, I think a real big, so the real good news is more and more companies, I think, are realizing org design is a capability, you know, something that you should build internally. And so you see these opportunities pop up. This particular group was part of an org effectiveness group. So that was a big conversation too. Where does it fit, right, in the organization? And like some of you are mentioning, even though it was org design and they had a few folks working under org design, they were under the org effectiveness umbrella, so to speak, along with change, along with workforce planning, along with transition. So you can see right there, there's probably right some overlaps. And so good news is we want to build this thing. Challenge is, well, who's going to be doing what still? And then you have your HR business partners as well. And so a lot of it, what they described their challenges were coming up with something that's enough of a thing to go help folks, right? And what is that? What does that look like? And so they talked about trying to educate folks through some lunch and learns, through some basic info on here's what it is. So there was an element of that. And then trying to find some projects they could work on. But where they described themselves at in the maturity model was they probably weren't ready for some of these big enterprise-wide things yet. And so they were going to work towards that, try to find some quick wins, you know, things they could get their arms around. But that was a lot of the discussion was just how do you position it? What's enough for the upskilling versus doing? And then who's doing what? And they were putting a lot of energy into just even designing for themselves, so to speak, you know, almost like process mapping and RASi type, you know, decision-making or accountability efforts.
One adjacency here was Rupert Morrison's discussion, one of the ones I was actually in, and his presentation was focused on data. I remember the conversation kind of transitioning away from data-driven design and probably, you know, somewhere in the midpoint towards how do you actually do it? And, you know, he shared some of the similar things that we're talking about here, where he compared org design to financial planning and analytics, like an FP&A organization, you know, which is tied to the annual strategy planning and things like that. So his premise was organizations need to establish an OP&A function, which is this org planning and analytics, to always, you know, I was taught that strategy drives your design. So if you've got that, you tie the org design function to that strategic planning process, and you always have that org planning analytics going on so that you can always kind of tweak and optimize. And there was a lot of discussion around where should that live and does HR have the capabilities to do it? Does it live in finance and things like that?
That was really interesting, Adam, I thought. Mm-hmm. It was just another way of, you know, what your org design function might look like, but it was a very different beast. It wasn't like necessarily consulting, like most of org design functions, they sort of reflect in some way, some type of consulting business. Right? And that was an analytics team like set up really to collect data and inform decisions with data and do that at the top of the organization. So like, get closer to the decision makers because you're providing data that's equally as important as FP&A, because like 60 or 70% of your costs are coming from people, right? So why is it that we're not thinking about, and his argument was skills aren't enough, right? Like, or talent's not enough, it's how they're organized that's also important, and you can't make decisions about that, you know, unless you've got data, and you can't be agile around with your organization. All the jobs are going to change. You've got to be looking forward, and you can't be agile unless you've got data. So he was, it was a really different sort of vision for what an internal function might look like.
And it was more tied to the business. Because it was, you know, for those that have been involved in like sales and operational planning processes and how finance is involved there in some of those key decision making and, you know, to enable, you know, revenue generation and stuff like that, there's just kind of no consideration usually for, okay, is the org set up in a way that is going to help us achieve this, these strategic goals? So having that, you know, org planning and analytics as part of the strategy was, it's a really interesting take, and tied to business planning. So,
and I will just say, for those who weren't at the conference, one of the running threads through the conference, in the sessions, outside the sessions, in the hallways, was where does org design live? So that was definitely a running thread. All right. Thumbs up, either physical or in the reaction button, if you would like to move on to the next session. And is there a thumbs down if you want to keep talking about this? Oh, no, there's only a thumbs up. So thumbs up if you want to move on to talk about the next session. I'm seeing somewhat of a quorum here.
I'm just still fighting my thumb.
All right. So I think, Tanya, correct me if I'm wrong, the next one was the Michael Arena 2023 and Beyond session, which Aileen, I think you volunteered to share some key takeaways.
Yeah. And I think if it works okay to share my screen, I just wrote some things so that I could share it visually. I mean, it's not even visual.
I did too, even though Adam said not to, I still did.
Okay. So here's what stuck with me. So first of all, the quote that he said right at, I feel like, the beginning of his talk was what I'm still thinking about, which is the future of organization design is social, not structural. I've been thinking a lot about that, because also, I mean, even just, you know, you take the STAR model, for example, right? There's a people piece, and then there's structures or processes or various things, but it's like people make up structures and people do the process. Like, everything boils down to people. So things he talked about that was interesting to me is this, what I took away is kind of like, who's really in charge. And so, you know, we have kind of the old typical, org chart, right? So sort of pyramid, who's at the top, who reports to who, and, you know, down and so forth. But when he talked about sort of the network mapping and the relationship clustering, sometimes there's someone in there who, it's like, if you really want to get something done, you go to that person because they know all the people and it branches out from there. And he talked also about bonders and bridgers in these networks. So bonding happens kind of in small groups, like a group bonding and connecting with each other, but bridgers being the people that bridge different groups or bridge outward across areas. And he, I'm sure I'm going to get the percentage wrong, but he was saying that they were like 30 or 60% more valuable to be like, to have bridgers, because they connect across these different connections. So they take the connections within bonded groups and can connect it across multiple bonded groups. So he talked about the importance of, I mean, both of those clearly, but certainly having bridgers, especially as you have differentiated bonded groups. And then I just felt like there was a lot that he talked about that was centered around getting things done through connection. And I'll just stop sharing here. My takeaway just listening to him was really about the importance of these networks, building these networks, communicating well, connecting well, because when people aren't connected, when they're disconnected, when they're not getting along, when they're at odds, it's very hard to get anything done, even if it's something that makes sense, even if it's something that people commonly buy into. If the connection isn't there, it's increasingly hard to do. So to me, it referred back to, again, that first quote in which he said that the future is social, not structural. And so to me, I'm still kind of taking away that it all comes down to relationships, I think, with ourselves, and then I think with each other. And that's ultimately how things get done.
If helpful, I can, sorry to interrupt real quick, but Michael did do a one-pager takeaway that was kind of an overview of his session at Inhuva. Yeah. So I can share that.
While you're doing that, Eileen, there was the pre-workshop, and I think you're in the pre-workshop. Org Design 101, and Cynthia Escamilla, who ran that, she just put up like a classic slide of integrating mechanisms from like something that's, you know, highly complex and structured like a matrix design to the least sort of formal, which was trust. And Michael's stuff just made me think of like really like you're building, trying to build trust into your organization, which is a very different design challenge than a lot of things we do in org design, which is, you know, like how are we going to structure it, what processes like are going to be in place and what talent you need. But that was like how do you make a network work? Well, it needs to have trust, and so, you know, there's a much bigger link then to culture and in designing a great organization.
Yeah, I really felt that too. And I think, I mean, I feel like I'm quoting something out of a book somewhere, but it's kind of like, you know, things move at the speed of trust, basically. Mm-hmm. So when people trust each other, they can get things done more easily versus everything else just becomes roadblocks if you don't have those built relationships. And how much just naturally happens with people when they're naturally given the autonomy to do what they're capable of doing, they're given the governance to make decisions that they need to. And again, I think that all comes from building relationships to, like you said, Keith, build that trust. Yes, speed of trust, yes.
Stephen Covey, and he actually goes as far as to calculate, I led this session, to calculate the dollar cost of lack of trust.
Right, that's interesting.
It was fun, because it's much more than you, when you start to calculate it, it's like, oh, it's worth it to build the trust.
Right.
So I do have a question. Did Mike only talk about trust networks, or did he talk about other types of networks that exist in systems? You know, like you have knowledge networks, or you may have like information flows networks, which are very interesting for processes, because normally, you know, Conway's law says that the even technology will follow the actual networks that occur, or the actual information flows. So I'm asking because of the emphasis in trust. So I was wondering if he talked about other types of networks.
I don't remember. Just limited to trust.
I'd like to comment here on this. I think the thing that, and I love the way, you know, Aline led on this. One of the things that stayed with me throughout the conference was his concept. He talked about bonding versus bridging, and I think of bonding as within a group and bridging as across groups. But the really important thing for me that stuck, that was different than anything that I've heard before about social networking, was the idea that those two forms of networking can be used to serve different purposes in the innovation and productivity stream. And he talked about discovery, development, diffusion, you know, and delivery, and how basically bridging is needed for discovery, you know, bridging across teams, across groups, across organizations is needed for discovery. Of new concepts, and development basically takes then the work back in to a smaller group, a smaller team where bonding is needed. And then for diffusion of a concept or a developed product or concept, bridging is necessary. And then you go back to bonding for delivery. And I found that concept of following that stream of innovation and of productivity and the moving back and forth between those two concepts of bridging and bonding, really, really interesting. And yeah. The thing that he said, and I wrote this down as I was looking at this morning again, was that he talked about learning organizations need to balance their time across those dimensions long term, and that they generate 25% more insights when they use both of those bonding and bridging concepts, that they increase speed by 10 times, that they scale solutions 3 times more effectively. And it's that agility that an organization has to move among those different, that different type of networking, those networking modalities, that's going to make a difference now going forward. And so that's what really struck me about that session.
Yeah. So, Kathy, that's like a fantastic overview, by the way. So Giselle, I'm not sure if it like directly answers your question, but what Michael did cover, like exactly what Kathy went through, but it's basically you got to look at the work type of work and then work out, and then, you know, whether it's in discovery, development, you're diffusing or scaling it, or you're delivering, and then work out what sort of bonding or bridging networks you need. That was the way he looked at it. So I don't know whether that sort of gets it. You were talking about some other sorts of network, knowledge yeah. network, et cetera. I'm not sure he didn't cut it in those sort of dimensions in his presentation, but he gave us that framework to start to think about, this is the sort of work, what type of network would be appropriate for this phase?
Oh, fascinating, fascinating. Yeah. Now I get it. Thank you so much. Thank you. Anyone has any other materials on that, that's...
Yeah, it was really good. And I love what you were saying there, Kathy, because that was sort of one of my key takeaways from the whole conference too. But just to add to what you said, he had a couple of other little gems in there that I wrote down. So we talked about that during the beginning of the pandemic, we did really well with bonding, like continuing to work with the teams we worked with, but really bad with bridging. And bridging really suffered. And what he said was, like, bonding is good for belonging and getting stuff done and really focused work. But the bridging was where you get your energy. And that's where, without that yeah. energy, you burn out and you lack engagement. And that was pretty eye-opening to me. Like, because I'm very interested in how energy flows through organizations, and it flows through the bridging. So I thought that was sort of a little gem that he snuck yeah. in.
Thank you. I remember that as well. That was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm seeing the question of Mark about the bonding and bridging. So what I know about networks, and this is very interesting, we tend to overemphasize bonding, but when you have a very strong bonding, your clustering coefficient gets high, meaning that you actually may close your group. So that is the interesting thing, that you may belong, but at the expense of going across. So you may actually create more silos if the bonding is way too strong. So again, like that dance between bonding and bridging, I think that, and what accurate, like I have never thought about it, but it is true. We have stopped bridging. Like no wonder it feels so isolating, and no wonder the silos are so big. So that was like a super quote. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Thank you. Mm. Oh, and thank you for what you're putting there. I'm going to download that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, cool. Thank you, Jerome.
Just the words, so the way you led it off, Aline, reminded me of the social, and Kathy, you referred to it as social network analysis. That's what when we first did this, we did this with Harley Davidson in like 2001, 2002, social network analysis. Now it seems like they're using the term org network analysis, unless I'm mistaken. Yeah. Which I find interesting itself, given that leading quote is, and going back to what Adam was talking about with what OrgView and others are putting out there, it feels different if you're doing the social network analysis, just even saying that word versus org network analysis, yeah. It almost feels more mechanical and more like you're trying to qualitate something, if you will. And then the missing piece, of course, is in my opinion, is great, you've got this data, but what are you doing still to look at the work and the flow of that work and the mechanisms? And so it's good to raise something, but sure, everyone's going to Jimmy for some information, but is he just the hero? And what's it really telling us? So I like that reminder.
There's always been that tension between, does culture drive the structures, our structures, or do the structures drive our culture? And honestly, I don't know anymore which is the case, right? So, you know, sometimes our culture affects the decisions we make and the types of structures we choose to design. And other times the structure influences the culture. And I don't know which anymore is more influential. Do you design for the culture you want, or do you let the culture produce I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, I have one other thing. Whenever I see a presentation on ONA or social network analysis, and you've got all your, they put up the network diagrams and like what's being said is always like really fascinating. But I look at the diagrams and like I go, and this is like, I don't know, looking to the sky and saying, that's a bull, or that's, it's like this drawing patterns out of, like, you could tell a different story from the same information. I don't know, like, I feel like there's, like, for it to get more traction, it needs a better way to be, like, I know it's a visualization of the organization, it's complex, it's a network, but there needs to be some better way to do it. I don't know how other people feel about that, but I always get a little bit
I agree. Know,
like you kind of like you could be making up any story from what, like I was looking at some of the things Michael had up and I thought, oh, they don't look that different. Now you're telling a totally different story. And I'm not doubting his legitimacy at all, but I get that every time I look at these diagrams.
There is that like so what? Like you've got the data, but it's like they go crazy with the data and then they lack the so what? Like what are we looking at? And the only time I've ever seen a compelling so what was a guy who's based in Budapest. Anyway, they were looking at communication to do their network analysis and using the results to inform team formation based on who's interacting with who the most and making decisions about whether they should put these people in the same teams or not. Because if they're working cross boundaries, why not put them in the same team? So they were tapped into, Microsoft's doing it more and more now for those that use, Office 365 and things like that, where it shows you work on files the most with these people and things like that. You can kind of see those networks of who's actually really working with who, and then kind of decide, team formation with it. That's the only time I've ever seen, the so what of doing org network analysis. So
I'm reading.
I can just come in on Adam's example. At Qualcomm, we used a network analysis to look at how we were integrating an acquisition, and it gave us some really good insights as to why things were not happening very well in Chennai, because the office had really no linkages into, into Qualcomm. There was still sort of a few into the old, the original company, the target, but they had never really been integrated into the part of, the US organization that they needed, where they needed the connections. So actually kind of doing that analysis really kind of highlighted that for us.
What sorts of things were you looking at, Nuala, to determine that?
So this is quite a few years ago. So Microsoft wasn't as, Office wasn't as
useful.
But we did look at who was emailing who, because email is like a big, Qualcomm runs on email. We also actually talked to kind of key people on both, sort of across both sides of, the target and Qualcomm, to say who we actually did interviews. We asked people, who are you talking to? Who are your connections? So we kind of identified who those bridges were. So it was a kind of a combination of interview and then just looking at the emails and meetings, who was in meetings. That's the other thing we looked at.
There was certainly a lot of talk about ONA this year. I remember last year it was the one presentation, and this year it seemed to dominate and was a thread across, not dominate, but it was certainly a thread across multiple sessions. All right. Anything else on the Michael Arena session anyone wants to share?
I just want to comment on what an incredibly dynamic speaker he was and how he kicked off the conference. For those of you who weren't there, he just created a level of energy. The content was very cool, but he just created a level of energy that launched the conference in a really powerful way.
Yeah, it was a great start. So some of the feedback, Kathy, that we got, and I don't know if it came from anyone on this call, but was really, they loved that presentation. I would love to have had 30 minutes at the table to sort of unpack it and talk about it. And because there was a lot of, it generated a lot of conversation and we kind of, it wasn't that time. So yeah, but it really hit the mark, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed. All right. If we can jump to the next most popular vote, which was the disruption resistant org from Tony Buffum, am I saying it right, from Upwork. And I think, Keith, you were going to give us some key takeaways for that.
Yeah, I think this is like at a high level, pretty, you know, like some pretty sort of basic ideas. So like largely like the shape of the workforce is likely to change. So you have, and if everyone, so I'm not sure, I assume most people will know what Upwork is, but Upwork is it's a platform that allows you to access skills on a hourly or project basis of like any type of skills. Most, a lot of it is like, we like the ODF website we designed with someone we found on Upwork, and you go to Upwork and you can look for web designers that know WordPress, and it'll bring you up people in India or in the Philippines, all over the world, and they'll have ratings against them as to how, you know, from their past work, and you can choose someone to work with, and you can find them, so you can choose on price, you can see rates, it's all very transparent, and it's a way to engage the gig economy. So that's like how you might engage on one side. On the other side, it's a way for people to sell their skills and not be in a traditional job, right? So, you know, the implication, so with what Tony's presentation is really about is, okay, so if the gig economy is rising, so there's more opportunity and better way for us to access these skills, how might you then as an organization think about how you do your work, right? So what do you get done through someone who's in a permanent job? What do you access in terms of skills that you can buy on the market? Are you able to get actually better skills by going out if you can chunk your work up in a way that enables you to go and get, you know, some really top level skills to do something, and maybe you can create more meaningful work internally as well. So there's a lot of implications about what the boundaries of an organization, and there's a whole lot of things around that, like how you manage your culture off the back of that. Tony wasn't talking, he was not the expert to talk about those things. It was really more to present, here's structurally what's happening in the talent markets. And so as org designers, like how do we either utilize that or think through the implications of that for the organizations we work with, right? And he, you know, some of the interesting things, I mean, he and both Brave New Work, but mentioned the Hollywood model, which people seem to like. I don't know whether it's new, but maybe it's more relevant now. So the Hollywood model being basically you just bring together either individuals around a particular, you know, whether it's a movie or an ad, but you're bringing in people that fit the purpose for that particular assignment, and they're not connected to that for life. They're going off and working on something else. So this project skill-based model of, and how might that be applied within organizations as well? So more dynamic, more flexible, maybe better skills fit for purpose at a particular point of time. But, you know, I mean, the questions that it raised for me, or raises for me are, so what are the implications that, you know, you would need to manage? Are we just creating more connections? Is there more coordination cost, you know, with these sort of models? Like, do we lose cultural identity, you know, those type of things, or how would we prevent that? Anyway, so that was sort of my main takes from what Tony spoke about. And he did a very good job. He's a very good presenter as well. So he's, so it's great to have him up there. And he was a little bit from our org design conference, a little bit of a different, you know, he didn't come in as an org design specialist. He came in as someone who's involved in something that I think is impacting org design and that we need to know about.
That's interesting, because that touches more on the reward. If I think of the Galbraith STAR model, because that's the model I follow, that focuses more on the reward section of the STAR than I think any other topic we've touched on there. Because, I mean, if we're talking about that's your talent model, right? Whether you go out and get the skills and things like that, you kind of, whether you're paying hourly, whether you're paying on a deliverable basis, you know, do we just need somebody for a project, or are we bringing them in full time? And then, you know, in the US, you've got things that complicate where people might not want to go on Upwork because they need health insurance and benefits, which only come with being an employee, stuff like that. So that kind of touches on the reward side, probably more than many other topics do. So,
yeah.
Adam, I'm glad you brought that up, because when you mentioned the Hollywood model, I can't help but think about the screenwriter strike. And now, like, some of the actors are going to that. Yeah. So apparently there are some stakeholders that aren't very hot on that level.
Yeah. It doesn't work for everyone.
No. Yeah.
No, there's, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not necessarily, like, it's one of these things. It's not necessarily a better, well, we don't know whether it's a better way. And maybe that means there should be some better research, like, on whether it's a better way, or it's a bit of, How do you use it? How do you keep the things that you want and get the benefits of what that offers? But right. it's enabled by technology that's available now.
Right? Yeah. So there was kind of, on the other side of this, there was, did anyone see in the New York Times Magazine last weekend, an article is When Your Boss Is an App? And it's really kind of written from, well, it's, wow. And it really highlights kind of, you know, sort of, it's really looking at this whole kind of gig thing and things like Upwork and just how it's actually kind of, you know, what the implications are as an employee, you know, or not an employee. It was really interesting, you know, for some people, it's an absolute positive, but for a lot of people, you know, no benefits, no insurance, you know, so it's good to sort of think about the other side of it, not just kind of here are the benefits to the organization.
Yeah, and it'll work differently in each country, right? Like if I was back in the UK, where I got free health coverage and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly.
I would find the project model much more attractive, because I have more of my basic needs covered than I do in this country, so it's going to work differently in different parts of the globe.
Right. But it's really complex, because we did a project for a European company. And one of the challenges is if you have for the Netherlands, if you have an even one person in a country, that creates a corporate presence there. So you know, there's a lot of complexity with remote work that we don't always think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that struck me in that presentation too was you talked about, instead of trying to own people, create seamless access to them. Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah,
but
right.
But then he also talked about, well, start with defining the work and then figure out how to get it done. But to me, in my agile person brain, I think that seems like a lot of big upfront design in order for you to be able to then get people to work on it. Whereas I'd rather have smart people figuring out the thing, right, than having to have these chess masters figure everything out and then like go have some soldiers execute it. So I wonder like how much big upfront design we need to make that gig, to make everything a gig.
I think it's kind of a capability. Somebody once taught me that, you know, when you do design around org capabilities, you take all the kind of you take your value chain and you say, which capabilities within the value chain are absolutely critical and strategic to our business? Those are the capabilities that we're going to focus building on in-house. And then the more stuff on the outside, more tactical stuff, would be things that they could staff differently. And then, you know, that would be something that you could say outside. But if you then put those capabilities outside, you have to build a different capability internally to manage those. So it's a choice, right? You either hire people to do it internally and then they do it themselves, or you develop very good vendor management internally and you're managing people from Upwork. But you're right. It's sort of like, do I want to spend time doing it myself, kind of walking it through, or do I want to pay someone else to do it, but then have to manage them? It's kind of that decision. Yeah. But.
And to build on what you're saying, Adam, and the reward system as well, depending upon how you organize all that, you'll want to recruit and pay incrementally more for certain kinds of talent if it's talent that leverages the organization model.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting what's possible. You know, like, its promise would be, I don't know, like, work's unpredictable, it's unknown, you don't know how long you're going to need capabilities and skills, you know, you need it for this particular piece of work. Your access of the things that are enduring, yeah, you have permanent roles. And it's and so you can manage you could potentially manage your business more cost effectively. There'd be some people, their lifestyle, if they, like we saw the Microsoft presentation that, you know, is talking about people's desire for flexibility and how strong that dominant that is. So this is, you know, on that other side, it could be a vehicle to provide that flexibility, you know, where you've got organizations saying, I don't trust, like their data said, organizations largely don't trust that people are really working that hard at home. People think they're working hard at home. Most people want a lot of flexibility. So this is like, it's not a panacea, but it could solve some of those problems potentially.
Yeah. One of the things that for this connected to me, Nuala, actually reminded me of your presentation with Sarah, is one of the spots you and Sarah identified sort of three spots of interest as after we all went through. And one of them was kind of that we have a focus on like long-term permanent employees and people who do sort of, I'm forgetting the words you used, but I would say more non-routine things versus routine rote. And so what that, you know, connected to me here too is something I felt Tony was pointing to was having people who do maybe some of those distinct things that can be given to someone if it's given to someone in your org who they're there to do something else, but then they're spending time on that kind of stuff, you're not really making the most of someone's contributions. And so I appreciated the idea of how can we get the work done the best we can? And what's the mix of people who are maybe full-time versus not full-time? It could be all not full-time. Because I think what happens a lot of times too with full-time folks is it's like, oh, Aline, you just made that slide. You could be our graphic designer. Great. Why don't you do these PowerPoint presentations? And I'm thinking like, I just used a template. And I mean, I guess I could do that and it'll be okay. Or we could go find an actual graphic designer who do a great job and spend less time than me. And I'll do the thing that I actually came to do. So I think it's quite intricate. And I'll just add this one other thing, you know, the comment about how employment is all connected with other things like benefits. I hope that somewhere we're factoring in, like I would like to disentangle health benefits or other benefits from work, because I think that holds people hostage
in their jobs.
Move country. Yeah.
I know, that's a very good idea, Aline. Someone should think of that.
Yeah.
I think you should run in some election.
Oh my gosh. Well, so just being working for myself, I do cover California. And I think number one, I never want to go back to working in a 9-to-5 full-time situation. But if I were, part of my negotiation would be, I don't want your health benefits. I'm going to keep mine separate. You're going to give that to me either in more salary or time off or something else, because I think we just need to start like weaning that away.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The money, right? If we can just get the money to pay for it from a different, I like the thing that always gets me is that sometimes the gig work is lower paying than a full-time job, which seems like it should be more because you're not getting the benefits. You should be able to pay for them.
Right. Yeah.
All right. I know we just have a few minutes left. Well, we actually have 7 minutes left, but I wanted to see if the group, if anything we talked about today or anything we didn't talk about today are things that you might like to see more of through the year. If you maybe want to just throw those in the chat, that would be great. And then we can make sure we're hitting on all of the areas of interest.
So, Jardina, I just had a comment.
Sure.
And I can put it in the chat if you want. But what really struck me over those 4 days was how many relatively new, bright, excited, younger, and I'm in my 70s, so younger is everybody, younger folks were there. I wouldn't say not wanting to be taught, but wanting to learn together. And what struck me is we had small groups of, you know, all ages, and everyone was contributing and everyone was learning. And I'd like to see that continue. I mean, that mix of experience, internal, external, old, young, very experienced, just learning, to me was just incredibly invigorating.
That's something that as the ODF, we've been trying to do more of. I think it's something that we've been aware that it's been a gap historically, and we've been trying to be deliberate about it, but challenged by actually being deliberate about it as well. So encourage all of you, if you know a young person, encourage them to attend one of our events, because we've been trying to get more of that diversity of age across the community, so that we can all share that. So as you as members can help with that, we'd really appreciate it. So.
I was about to say, I was one of those folks sitting with Richard, and it was a really good learning experience. Just getting to meet everyone and chat and learn from all of your experiences. Totally agree with that. And it's really nice to see all of you again, actually.
Hey. Nice to see you too.
Yeah. But there's so much now that, there is so much. I mean, Richard's point's so on the mark, because there's so much for everyone to learn, like about ways of working, right? Which is kind of what we're designing. And like everyone, like if you're not a digital native, you're approaching it very differently. And there's so much for us to learn and think about. So yeah, that was good. Some of the feedback that came back just in our survey of things that were interesting, like one of them was around generational topics as well, like how are we designing for future generations? So yeah, again, just to double down on Richard's point, I think.
Great. Any other takeaways from the conference that we didn't want to cover, but anybody wants to mention or ask about if you weren't there?
I wasn't there, but I've just added some notes in the chat around things I found interesting in this conversation. As you've talked about, like ways that we contribute different seasons of business cycle, like there's things that we contribute obviously when we're, you know, rehashing our strategy, or we're, you know, going through a major acquisition, or, you know, there are things that we do at a very strategic level, but there are also things we do at a very tactical level as we're making the decision to build a new capability or insource a capability. I think those are really interesting to think about, how we contribute at the strategic level, but also how we bridge and drive org effectiveness.
Yeah, good point. All right. Well, I think we're winding to a close here. Thank you everyone for your participation and your feedback. I see Tanya. Tanya, what do you have in here? Anything about the...
I was just letting Humaira know that we had a conversation on where does org design reside as one of our community conversations. Dennis Hutchinson from Chevron was posing that question. And so we've got a recording of that community conversation that took place maybe 6 months ago, 7 months ago. So I will pull the information about it and put it in chat if you've got a minute to hold online.
Great. Well,
and if anybody does want to host a conversation, you don't have to wait for the ODF to put one of these events on to join. If anybody has a topic, just reach out to Tanya or one of us on the call here, and we can help make that happen. Because I think, as you all know, like, if there's a topic of interest, like, we will flock to it and talk about it for hours and hours. So don't wait for us. If you've got a topic, just let us know, and we can you know, get something on calendar and talk about it. So
yeah, great point, Adam. Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining today and engaging. And we hope to see you on more of the calls and maybe even leading one of the community conversations.
Thank you for holding this.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks. Nice talking to everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for hosting, Jardina.